Hello and welcome to More Than Tracy Turnblad, the podcast about fat representation in entertainment. My name is Abby Rose Morris, and today I am here with Lexi Schreiber, aka the Fat Ingenue. She's a freelance theater artist and TikTok creator who I became aware of through social media, and now we are friends. And turns out we also went to the same college. So this is the longest ever episode of More Than Tracy Turnblad, so I'm going to keep this brief, but I watched Thunder Force this week, and it was awesome. I was really nervous about it going in because so many of Melissa McCarthy's roles have kind of just rubbed me the wrong way as far as fat phobia. You know, she just really tends to lean into those like gross, disgusting stereotypes, sexually aggressive stereotypes, and those are some of my least favorites, I have to be honest. But even though the character that she played did sort of lean into some of those things, like there's a whole joke where she only wants to eat raw chicken because of her superpowers and how they've like changed her body's like chemical makeup or whatever. But it actually was funny. Like it was funny. It was a joke that would seem like it was a fat joke in, you know, in another context, because like any gross joke is automatically a fat joke when it's a fat person being gross, but this wasn't. And the reason for that, I think, is because this movie had not one, but two plus size leads. And that is pretty much unprecedented. So like, hello, that's amazing. And the reason that that sort of allows for these jokes to happen without them being fat jokes is because, in contrast to Melissa McCarthy's character, you had the Octavia Spencer character. And she was completely not a fat stereotype. She was really smart, a bit uptight, really protective of her daughter. Like, she was a completely different character type, as she should be, because they are two completely different actresses and people. And seeing two different types of people in a movie and both of them just happen to be fat, I feel like that's just inherently challenging stereotypes because there is more than just one type of fat person. And while we might see the sort of character type that Melissa McCarthy's character was in a lot of fat phobic contexts, in this context, it actually was not. I mean, first of all, their size was never mentioned. Like, it just was never mentioned at all. And it was still just sort of allowed to be funny. Like, that's not part of the characterization, was not their size. I can't believe they did this. I can't believe Hollywood did this. I'm still just like so blown away. And like, this should just be the bare minimum, because just like seeing yourself represented as a whole person rather than just like a really demeaning stereotype, of course, that should be the bare minimum. Like, that should be the standard for all marginalized identities. But it's so rare that it happens. So I will be celebrating, thank you. By the way, the raw chicken thing was also applied to Jason Bateman. Like, there's also a joke about how his character loves raw chicken. And he's this, spoiler alert, he's the love interest for Melissa McCarthy's character. And they sort of bond over loving raw chicken. And it's just funny. It's not demeaning and sad. At least it wasn't to me. Because when you're like seeing in real time that this can also be applied to someone who isn't fat, like it just makes it clear that it's not a fat joke. I feel like it just really goes to show that like you can make these jokes. There's a way to do it. There's a way to make these jokes without it being at the expense of fat people. There's a way for fat people to be doing this gross out humor without it being like gross out because of their size. And that was super exciting to me. And that just like gives me kind of hope for the future of media and entertainment, because a lot of horrible things are happening in the world currently. So it was great to not only just see this like funny movie, but it happened to star two plus size women and their weight was never mentioned. And it just like kind of gave me hope for the future of the industry, because that is actually a great stride. But in the way that it was a great stride, it's not like momentous moment. Like, it's not patting itself on the back for that. It just was. There also was like one tiny moment in there where like gender neutral pronouns were used, I think. And with that too, I was like, one day this won't have to be a big deal to us. One day we're not going to be like, they did it, you know? It's just going to be par for the course in these movies that are fun. And also it proves that like you can have a fun movie without punching down. So I highly recommend Thunder Force. You must check it out. It was delightful and it was a great just like funny, kind of comforting kind of movie, and just wholesome and lovely. I completely recommend it. So if you are listening to this and you have been listening regularly and you have not left a review and you're on Apple Podcasts right now, this is your reminder to scroll right down to the bottom of the page, rate it with one click or review with a few words. I would love that so very much. So helpful to me. For the next 3 reviews, I will read them out on the podcast and give shout outs as I have seen other podcasters doing. So let's do it, guys. Tell me if you like it. I need to know, because the tricky thing about having a podcast too is that like there's not comments underneath it. So like people don't just discuss every episode. So that's what you can do in the reviews, especially if you like it. If you don't like it, you know, as they say, if you like it, tell your friends. If you don't like it, tell your enemies. So now that we've gotten that out of the way, it's time to welcome our guest, Lexi. Hello, Lexi.
Hi, how are you doing?
I am doing all right. So how are you?
I'm good. I'm surviving, really, yeah. Truly, honestly. Like, I am good, but life in this weird limbo of like COVID and whatever post-COVID is.
Right.
And I'm busier, and it's really strange.
Yeah.
Especially when I'm someone that used to have like 6 jobs a week, most of the time, you know, like, and it's a different feeling. It feels harder right now. And so I am adjusting to whatever this new future is.
For sure.
You know, I guess it's also my excuse for not posting in a minute on the Fat Ingenue, is because real tangible life had to become more important to me, because those numbers just go up and down so quick. And it's like, I am such a student of like wanting to be the best and validating myself with success. And so to have like such high numbers and then all of a sudden you're barely hitting 500, which like that even sounds insane, because like I haven't had 500 people see me perform in forever. So it's an amazing thing, but when you're getting thousands, like for you, hundreds of thousands
that
on
was
something,
one time. Like,
but still having, it is as difficult as people say to recognize the lack of control that you have when it's high,
so true,
and when it's low. And I'm not good at that. Like, I love school. I have an extra degree because I like structure and attainable short-term goals that other people set for me. And so with social media, no one's doing that for you. You have to figure it out. And it is as hard as people say. I feel like just being honest about why I haven't been able to create in over a month is just really, I just don't want to pretend that I'm like so busy. I just don't have anything to give currently.
Okay, so let's talk about what you are here to talk about.
Yes.
Oopsie, already a tangent.
I know. I am the queen of the tangent. I'm so sorry.
Oh, no, you're fine. I am absolutely like, either I'm enabling you or I'm like just as responsible. So let's talk about how you got into the arts. Like, what's your origin story?
I started dancing when I was 2. I started at the Jewish Community Center in Houston, Texas. the one that there was a big J and a little J, and I was at the little J because we lived like closer to Katy, so it was closer.
Means nothing to me.
Yeah. Anyone in Texas listening, shout out Houston, Katy, but just felt significant to say, because there are 2 Jewish community centers in Houston. Mm-hmm. That was like it for me. I loved performing. I fought very hard to be the line leader of the skip line. And I think we did Winnie the Pooh and like pink leotards.
A fat icon, very, by the way.
Yes. Very cute. And I'm sure there's a picture I can scrounge up somewhere from that. And then I really just stayed in dance for the rest of, I stayed in dance all throughout high school too. And then my mom showed me like every great classic musical movie that's out there, from Annie to Gypsy to The King and I, all of them. She loved them, and my sisters and I would watch them. We like would watch the Cinderella, Rodgers and Hammerstein, Whitney Houston, Brandy one all the time. Of course.
So good.
But of course, for me, like Annie, the version with Carol Burnett and Bernadette Peters, that was everything. It was everything to me. I would sing The Sun Will Come Out Tomorrow for anyone that would listen, and most people who didn't want to listen. But at like, and in Houston, swim team in the summer is like a huge thing for communities, because it's so hot. So what else are we supposed to do? And at the end of swim meets, I would like get up on the picnic tables at the swim at this pool and like sing Sun Will Come Out Tomorrow. And I was like,
so
six.
Cute.
I was like, it's my time to shine. When I was really young, I did like a couple of performing arts, like summer camps, but then I was really lucky. The school district that I was in, like we were in choir throughout all of elementary school. And then I got to be in choir in high school. I mean, middle school, junior high and high school. And so it was like around us. So we didn't really seek it outside of my school experiences of it. Cause I don't think not a lot of other kids really were doing it. And I don't think my mom really thought about it, cause I was already dancing. So I had enough extracurricular to do. Then I like pursued choir and was doing that a lot. Loved singing, did it in high school. We had a huge choir in high school. There were two varsity choirs and I was in both of them by my junior year. I was in the show choir, and the show choir was only like 12 or 14 people. And we did our own musical, just the 14 of us. And then there was the spring musical that included the theater department and all anyone in choir that wanted to audition as well. So I was very lucky that my, you know, public high school was so supportive of theater and music and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And then so probably like going into my senior year was when I decided that I wanted to do this for real and wanted to go to school for it. I started taking voice lessons when I was a freshman in high school. And then I prepared for auditions, starting to just like get some musical theater songs, not really sure if I was going to do vocal performance or if I was going to do musical theater. But then I went to a fine arts college fair at University of Houston, where everything was only arts-based programs.
I went to one of those.
Yeah, it was very helpful because I had no idea what I was doing when I was looking for colleges.
Yeah.
So I got a lot of brochures and I ultimately decided vocal performance because I felt like I needed some sort of like backup plan. And I felt like music was a safer bet than theater at the time. Like at the end of the day, I could sing in a choir at a church or like, I don't know, do something vocally, teach music or something. So I went for vocal performance and I found UArts at that college fair.
I think I'd maybe heard of it before, but I remember getting a UArts brochure at the college fair. Mine was in Boston. I mean,
there was no way I would have ever found out about it otherwise, because I remember when my mom and I started telling people I was going there, they didn't think it was a real school and be like, they would be like, are you getting a bachelor's degree? Like, are you going for a certificate? Like,
same.
No one had any idea what we were talking about.
It's like, if you tell like people in the theater world, they'll know. But if you tell people who aren't lay people, they're like, the fuck?
Yeah. What are you talking about?
With UArts, they're always like, oh, I don't know that. And then you say, it's in Philadelphia. And they say, oh, Philadelphia. That happened to me so many times.
Yeah.
But
totally.
Continue.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really liked that UArts vocal department was said in the brochure that we like well-rounded vocalists that are trained in jazz, classical, and musical theater. And I kind of ignored the jazz part and was like, I don't care about that. But musical theater, the fact that they called out classical singing and musical theater was very important to me. And then they also had a musical theater minor for vocal major. So I was like, great, this is where I want to go. I came here to audition and I really, really loved it. I loved Philly as a vibe. I love that you're like in the middle of Center City, just living my like East Coast dream. So like I said, I was at UArts 2010, 2014 in the vocal department and musical theater minor.
And for those who don't know, I was at UArts 2015 to 2019. So we just missed each other.
Literally just missed each other. So wild. And I loved it there. I had a really, really great experience. I learned a lot. I went into college trying to be Patti LuPone or Kristen Chenoweth or mm-hmm. Audra McDonald, like just wanting to be whatever I could. And I really left feeling like I sounded like me. And I really am grateful for that. And then I took a year and was really lost trying to figure out what to do. I moved halfway across the country. So UArts like became my home. And then I felt completely disconnected from that.
Oh, so and it was,
It was a whirlwind. So, I was on the Theater Philadelphia page looking for jobs as we do.
Yeah. And Philadelphia is the backstage of Philadelphia or like the, I don't know, what's a New York specific one? Like the Playbill or whatever.
Yeah.
That's not New York specific either. I don't know.
Right. But those are the ones you go to.
Yeah.
It's great. And I found the Villanova Master of Art and Theater program through that. And I went to an open house and I really liked it and thought it could be interesting. And I've always wanted to get my master's degree. It's a weird thing, but it just has been a plan of mine. And I applied and I got in and I went and worked my butt off for 2 years in grad school and graduated in 2017. Mm-hmm. And I ended up doing an academic thesis about Jeanine Tesori, where I wrote a 46-page paper about her and I developed my own musical feminist musicology, where I like dissected a song from each of her shows and was trying to determine whether her work with Lisa Kron on Fun Home was any more feminist than her work with the men she had worked on with all of her previous shows. So Lisa Kron was the first time she worked with another woman and they won a Tony and her other shows didn't. So I was trying to determine if it was any more or less feminist than her other work. Which was really crazy because I didn't even know that feminist musical theater analysis was a thing and learned about it in college and it completely changed my life, or in grad school and it completely changed my life. And I also had really amazing opportunities of like, I was in a Greek play in grad school, which was not an experience I ever had as a music major instead of being a theater major. And then I also had the amazing opportunity to play Marmee in Little Women.
Aww.
And it was like a dream come true. And it was really, really awesome. And I was really lucky with my experience there. And I'm so glad for that degree because I know so much more about theater.
Yeah.
Because I didn't have that opportunity because I wasn't a theater major. Like that's really all it is. And so I'm really, am glad that I did that. And so then post-grad, I've just been doing whatever I can for whoever will pay me for whatever job they need. I feel like predominantly I'm like a music director a lot of the time, which is great for like for students, because I can't accompany, so I can't really do it professionally, but in professional theaters, I should say, because, you know, I'm a professional. I'm music directing, I direct and choreograph as well. I teach private voice lessons and I perform when projects that I care about like pop up, or like I've been very lucky that certain performance opportunities have just fallen into my world at the right time and happened to be the right fit.
Mm-hmm.
And and now in COVID life, I'm teaching mostly and very grateful for the opportunities that I've had throughout this whole year and such a weird time for theater.
Yeah.
But, you know, I do it for the kiddos.
So that's your whole life story. And now I'm going to ask you to go back through your life and tell me how size has showed up for you in all of that.
So the first time I ever knew that I didn't get something I wanted performance wise because mm-hmm. I was fat was when I auditioned for the drill team at my high school, my freshman year of high school. So in Texas, drill teams, dance teams, the people that dance on the field at the halftime show, very big. It's a huge thing.
Yes.
Think the Rockettes, but they're on a football field and sometimes they have on cute little like cowgirl looking outfits. Mm-hmm. and so I, of course, having danced my whole life was like, oh, this is it. This for me is going to be really great. Let's go. So you have to take like a dance class the first year to be able to audition at the, I think it's either the end of the first semester. So then you're in like the drill team prep class, the second semester of school. Mm-hmm. So I was in that class. I felt really confident. I had been dancing, you know, I was 14. I started dancing at 2. So I'd been dancing for a really long time. I knew that I was a really good dancer. I knew that I had a great stage presence because I, even at a young age, I always had somebody that I didn't know or some other mom in the class of a kid in the class that I was into coming up to me and being like, wow, I couldn't take my eyes off you or your presence, like just giving me compliments of mm-hmm. that the eye goes to me because I've got some sort of something on stage. Yeah. I also deeply loved it. I loved performing. So I just had that. I just knew I was good at it. Mm-hmm. You know, I took a lot of pride in being good at what I did. And so tryouts, we had to do this little combination. We had to do a kick line. It was like, you know, typical. And I felt really great. I did a double pirouette in my turn. And I'm dancing against a lot of girls who have never taken a dance class before this year in their life. Like, just like, I mean, it's a lot of girls, like a lot of people tried out. I think the drill team at the time had like 60 or more girls on it. So, mm-hmm. and like, people didn't make it exhibit A.
Yeah.
And they like at the end of the auditions, we all sat in the gym and they passed out letters to all of us at the same time. Mm-hmm. But we are all finding out whether we make it or not. And I opened the letter and I saw that I didn't make it. And I literally like screamed.
Oh my God.
I got up. Like it wasn't like a like super dramatic, but I literally like let out a vocalization of my detest of this letter. And then I immediately just remember getting up and going to find my mom and being like, get me out of here right now. Mm-hmm. Because I knew that it was rigged. It was wrong. It couldn't be right. Like, mm-hmm. I knew that I had better dance technical skills than a lot of the girls that were already on the drill team.
Yeah.
I knew that it was about the fact that I didn't look how they wanted me to look. I was too big to be on the line. My legs would look different. My arms would look different, but it didn't like, I had been dancing with girls who were skinnier than me my whole life. So yeah. It just didn't make any sense to me how someone like me with dance training couldn't make the dance team.
Yeah.
And so after that, I begrudgingly like finished my PE credit that I had to have to graduate high school in that dance class and one extra semester of being in another dance class. And I dedicated myself to choir even more than I already was and dedicated myself to my studio, my dance studio that I was going to and like teaching extra classes, like assisting teach some extra classes. And when I was like a sophomore and junior, I asked my choir director if I could choreograph numbers for our spring show or if I could be the dance captain, or I honestly choreographed stuff for our fall production. Like I really just was like, okay, well, I'm going to find other ways to keep this skill going because it's a skill that's really important to me. And like dance is the reason that I'm here. Like that is my first introduction to performing before singing and acting. I feel like I learned how to act through dancing first. Like I learned how I watched teachers as I got older, and started taking lyrical and stuff change from like, do this number because it's pretty and nice, but then actually allowing us to tell the story of the song through our movement.
Yeah.
And so I really just did what I could. And then when I was like junior, senior, obviously totally over it, like whatever drill team, by being able to be supportive of all my friends that were on it and had made it instead of me, just totally acted like I didn't care about it. the at auditions, the director of the drill team, one of the directors of the drill team would use me as a success story of not making it.
What?
Mm-hmm. He'd be like, don't worry. If you don't end up making it, there are really great, and like would talk about my
success.
They'd
be like, well, Lexi didn't make it. So there are lots of good dancers who don't make
yeah.
it. Yeah. Oh, I mean, my God.
I don't know the exact phrasing, but I just remember, I feel like either she told it to me to her face or one of my friends was like talking about how she was like, proud in some way or something. I don't really know, but I was like, okay, well, they're not wrong.
Wild.
So whatever. Yeah, just reminding the children you don't need drill team. And just how stupid directors can be.
Yeah, for sure.
Because yeah, I just can't even imagine. I as a teacher now especially, I can't imagine like agreeing with a group of judges.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she just will mess up the line.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're any better or worse today. I do feel like when my sister was on the drill team and the captain of the drill team.
Oh my goodness.
I do feel like there was more diversity in body, I don't think there's anyone that was as big as I was at the time.
Yeah.
So, but you know, progress is okay in any way. So other than that experience of like deeply knowing that it was because of being fat and not because of my talent,
mm-hmm.
I just had been put into the mother aunt friend role.
Oh yeah.
And not realizing until later that, oh, it's not because I'm just such an outstanding comedic actress. It's because I didn't have a choice.
Yeah.
But then do other than to be.
I have heard that from a lot of people that they didn't think about it until they looked back years later and were like, oh, I had the opposite experience. I knew while it was happening every single time it happened. And honestly, I wish that I hadn't, because it was super painful as like a seventh grader to be like, oh yeah, I'm fat, so I'm the mom again. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Totally. I think that probably by my senior year, I definitely felt it, mm-hmm. because my director, who I deeply love still to this day and is a mm-hmm. huge support for me, but he chose musicals, both the show choir musical and the Big Spring musical. He chose shows for the same lead, for the same male lead,
mm-hmm.
and kind of fit all yeah. the rest of us that were there into the boxes of the other characters.
Mm-hmm.
And we did How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. And I had like a tiny glimmer of hope that I could be Rosemary, because especially after listening to Megan Mullally
yeah.
be Rosemary, I was like, I can slay this. Like mm-hmm. this, I can totally do this. I know that I can. But then as we got closer, I was like, I would always go to, I'm too tall for them, because I am 5'10".
Mm-hmm.
So that's another factor for me, that I'm very, very tall.
Yeah.
And that whole idea that men have to be taller than women to be believable as leads, all that stupid yeah. stuff.
It's all related.
Yeah, 100%. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I liked the sassy boss friend. I liked being Aunt March in Little Women and being mm-hmm. a bitch. I am sincere in that playing Marmee in grad school, because I was in Little Women in high school and then I was mm-hmm. Little Women in grad school. And while excited about Aunt March, and they built me this, the costumer definitely thought that I was going to be Aunt March and not Marmee. And she built me this like 6 foot across, it probably wasn't that tall, but it was a huge hoop skirt that I yeah. tried on before I got cast. Or no, after I got cast, I tried it on and it was huge. And I remember a director came in, she was like, not for Marmee, because it was just so audacious. And I would have loved to play Aunt March again, but I went in guns blazing for Marmee, and really, like, I love her. I love Marmee.
Yeah. Moms are great, like, characters some of the time. It's just frustrating yeah. when you're only put there for reasons that you know, like, are something mean that they're thinking about you. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Like, yeah, I would be, I'd be preparing for the Little Women audition and only thinking about choosing material that was Marmy style.
Yeah.
And I remember my friend going, well, why couldn't you be Joe? And I just looked at her and I was like, I can't even process that, right? Like, I can't even allow myself to believe that I'm going to be Joe. Number one, I can't sing astonishing. Number two, I just knew that it wasn't going to happen. I knew that I had to fight. I had to go in and just be Marmy in an audition.
Yeah.
Because I was up against women that were the correct age to play Marmy and not another 25-year-old, you know? And then, so I think the first time that it really hit me that I was in a predicament was when I was making a resume.
And then
realizing like how you should make your resume, like the right way or whatever. And realizing that I'm 22 and all of the roles, aside from Lucy Van Pelt, right?
Oh my God,
and Charlie
amazing,
Brown.
Though. I'm sure you were incredible as Lucy. I too only have a couple of non-mom roles and are Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally. Absolutely. Plays are as akin to this as well.
For sure. I mean, I think that in plays, it's talked about a lot more in the musical theater world, but I see this in straight theater so much. Of course, the older the play, the more narrow the tropes. And I did a whole segment in my solo show that this podcast is based on, all about how the descriptions of female characters in plays so often mention how attractive they are, how beautiful. Often they go out of their way to say thin. They like to use the word slender, especially. And it's like for such a huge percentage of characters that I'm like, oh my God, the only characters that I can play are the ones who are explicitly fat, which are few and far between. And then, of course, they're often like sad fat girls. So I think that this is not talked about in the straight theater world nearly often enough, although I also think that a lot of newer up-and-coming playwrights are doing amazing work and writing characters who are so interesting and so much more than what they look like. But you know, growing up in acting school, you're doing a lot of these like old white male playwright kind of scenes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. So, and then I was 22 with all these old women credits.
Yes.
And an audition book full of songs. Of older women, and thinking like, I don't have any age appropriate material. Like, what am I supposed to do? And what am I supposed to do for the next 10 years of my life till I'm old enough to be in those roles?
I've had the thought so many times, like, I'm going to just leave theater. I'm just going to like tap out for like 10 years, make a bunch of money or I don't know what, and then come back when it's time for me, you know?
100 Yeah. I mean, why
but I can't I think of anything to do in the meantime, so here we are.
Yeah, it's why I put so much energy into my teaching career. Number one, a teaching job is going to pay me, so I take the risk for them. And that stability of it is huge, of course, but at the beginning it definitely was, I have to fill my time between now and then. And now I am 29 and I still feel like it still is something I'm grappling with, of getting
for
into
sure.
those spaces.
Because even if you do fill your time and then move on to like the mom roles that you were like always told you would play, then like it still does feel like you missed out on a chunk of your like youth. Does that make
and
sense?
And also, I'm now competing with the skinny women for the same role.
True. Oh my goodness. That is definitely true.
Some of them are ones that have had credits before.
Right. Right.
Oh my God. It is just wild. Like, I know that this is as hard, you know, everyone warned me how hard this would be. I know that. But like, damn, it really is this hard. And if you are outside, it's this hard for the people that it benefits, and then it's this, like, as hard and harder for us.
Yeah.
For the people that don't benefit from it.
Yeah, that's so
true. And
you
and I are two white women, and right. we're young, and we're still like fighting this fight too.
For sure.
Because talent isn't the thing. It's not, you have to be Lizzo in a bikini shaking your ass playing the flute. Or like the level of the talent that is expected of us as bigger people, as Black people, people of color, anyone marginalized, is so much greater. And then, you know, the level of talent for people who fit into the system, it's still hard for them. And the expectation of their talent level is so high too.
Yeah. I hope this isn't super messed up to say, but like, how many times have I thought, oh, if I was thin, like, I would be getting so much more praise. Like, I would be getting so many more leads. I would be so, people would think of me as so much more talented. Like, people would be so much more impressed by me. You know what I'm saying?
100%. Because,
like, when looks are part of the package you're offering, like in musical theater, then that's like extra points for you. You know what I'm saying? And like, obviously we have our biases about like, we assume that people we find attractive are like nicer and smarter and like all this crap. And that's that, at this point in my life, that is the reason that I would want to get thin.
I cannot tell you how many times I have been running on a treadmill and thought to myself,
oh my God,
you have to do this to get into an audition space.
Yes. Yeah.
Like at my younger self, 100%. That crossed my mind working out. But I no longer equate health with weight because it is a capitalistic American idea that perpetuates the patriarchy and benefits the billion-dollar dieting system. And I hate it. And the only time I've ever successfully and happily gone to the gym on a regular basis was because I had to for my mental health.
Yeah.
So, like everything that annoys me these days, my number one go-to is anger, because grief. So anger is number one. Mm-hmm. And then it goes through a whole process, and everything that you're ever mad at can always be blamed on the patriarchy.
It's because so if we true.
Everything is to blame.
Oh my God.
For like the patriarchy is to blame for every single bad thing, perpetuating the idea that society defines who you are is the worst way that you can live.
Yeah. And body positivity as it is now is not really challenging that.
Yeah. It's a great point. I struggle with where I stand, good or bad, with body positivity.
Me too. I think both at the end of the day.
I think that the idea that believing you are beautiful is the like way to being happy is a very helpful idea. But I think what the better idea is that some days you look in the mirror, like for me, okay, this is my personal experience and my way of dealing with being a fat woman in America.
Yeah.
So I look in the mirror sometimes and I can go, oh, my waist looks great.
Yeah.
Oh my God. You cannot tell me that I don't have a beautiful face. Like these are things I will say out loud and that I can look in the mirror and feel that. Then there are days where I will turn to profile and be like, oh my God. And like also see every pore in my skin, see the one wrinkle in my brow that doesn't go away, even when my eyebrows are down, you know, see a white hip, like right root coming out of my red hair. There are those days where I can feel like that, but I literally just take a breath and I go, whatever. And I just like have that neutrality of being like, this is how I feel today.
Yeah.
Oh, am I PMSing? Am I bloated? No wonder I feel like crap. Like,
right.
There are so many, I do not value who I am based on what I look like.
Yeah.
And I think positive or negative of that is very toxic within itself.
Definitely.
And I think people who aren't, maybe people who aren't actors, because I feel like even before I was in therapy, the level of empathy that I have over other people is just on another level, because if you truly want to be an actor, you have to understand human behavior and what psychologically gets you there on some level.
Yeah.
And so if you don't have the understanding,
like,
I know too many
shitty men and like rapists and abusers who are good actors, but I do agree in general.
It's like, sometimes you're just good at it.
Sometimes you have empathy for some pockets of something and not for others for whatever reason. I think that's a great example, because a lot of really empathetic people fucking hate fat people, and like they're good people in the rest of their lives, but their attitude toward fatness is like so deeply ingrained in them that they end up being completely not empathetic, because that's just how they are now and how they've been conditioned.
Right. And that's how it spirals into patriarchy, because of these internalized feelings that people don't even know that they're having.
Yes.
And you can't come to those realizations unless you want to. It is so, everything that we're going through in society right now is incredibly frustrating because of that. Until you are willing to accept the information of your own internal biases, you can't even fathom it.
Yes.
Oh my God.
And that is true of every single one. So just across the board true. And I think that a lot of the time with the body feelings, body hate, body fear, whatever, body checking, all that stuff, I think that it goes so deep because we receive those messages beginning so young that it feels like it's an inherent part of us that we hate our bodies when they get bigger, or we hate this thing about our bodies. I have a bunch of stuff. Like, for me, it's body hair, it's gray hairs, like feeling such horrible, deep, deep shame about this stuff, like having crying breakdowns. And because those emotions are so intense, because it's like, you know, it's like supposedly like a referendum on your value as a person, that they feel real and they feel legitimate. And so being like, oh, that's just patriarchy, I think for some people makes them feel like their real feelings are being dismissed, their feelings at like not being acceptable to the patriarchy in whatever way. And this is something I have to tell myself all the time, because I still get deeply, deeply upset about the way I look, like frequently. And I know it's patriarchy that makes me want to, you know, get waxes and dye my hair and wear makeup and like all that stuff. So like, even though I know that patriarchy is what's making me feel that way, it's still there.
It doesn't negate. Here's the thing and this may sound self-righteous or like I know it all, because I certainly do not know it all. But I went through two major deaths of two important men in my life, my father and my grandfather, in 2020. Mm-hmm. I also got engaged and married in 2020. And such extreme highs and extreme lows that I didn't even know existed. And I have learned that life is so deeply complex of dualities. Mm-hmm. Happiness is not without sadness, because I was so happy when I got married. It was so wonderful, but it still doesn't negate that I feel bad about what I'm feeling. So that is part of life. Like, just because you know why something is happening doesn't mean that your feelings about it are invalidated. And one of the things that helps me when I'm feeling in this similar way that you're describing is thinking about how these body and female expectations in society don't even make the women who meet them feel good.
Yes.
I don't know if you've talked about Khloe Kardashian on any of your other podcasts.
Oh, but, not specifically.
Okay. Do you know what has gone on with her recently in social media?
I have heard about it, but I don't remember the details. And also, please fill our listeners in if they do not know.
Okay. I love pop culture. Okay, everyone. We're just going to start with that. I am a Bravo watching drag race worshiper. Okay. And I do love the Kardashians. I have two sisters, so I really just like relate to them. And I think in their heyday, it was a great time. So, you know, take everything that I say with a grain of salt, but, or, you know, just know I'm a good person who loves trash television. Yeah. So I'm a garbage person who's really cool. But so Chloe, this, her grandmother, MJ, she posted an unedited, unapproved photo of Chloe in a bikini on her Instagram. A couple reality television Instagrams took this photo and it was going around. I don't know what the commentary on the initial photo was until the controversy of it. Chloe started to go after small Instagram creators and threatened to sue them if they didn't take down the photo. From what I saw, which I believe I saw it on the Instagram account called Talk of Shame, and it's also a TikTok account, Talk of Shame. If you're a reality television person, highly recommend her. That even some Instagram accounts got like temporarily disabled from the platform because of this photo. So obviously these small Instagram creators were like, freaking out. Everyone's talking about Chloe. Everyone's like calling her out in her comments, trying to cancel her, whatever. She does it because the photo was unedited. So then she goes on her Instagram live and post this photo, like showing off her flat as hell stomach and her tiny waist and that huge butt, all this stuff, literally like bra, thong hanging out of sweatpants that are really low, and like trying to prove to everyone. And then she released this statement along with it about how she's been tormented in the media, which is true.
That's true, yeah.
And that she has a right to show her body in the way that she chooses to. The problem is, right, is that she's complaining about an unedited photo where she looks amazing. Okay. She just looks like a normal human, but a normal human who works out all the time.
Yeah.
You know, she doesn't look like a bodybuilder. She doesn't look like the crap that she's posting on Instagram. It's actually just, she looks normal. And she's gotten so insane with Facetune that it's a different person on the each time that she posts a picture. Like her body dysmorphia is, I could cry about how sad it is to me because
it is sad.
But then she releases the statement talking about how she has a right to Photoshop and stuff and how the media and the fans have come after them. And I'm like, but y'all are perpetuating the body standards.
Right. And at the same time, like the media is coming after them for this, yet the media is also perpetuating the body standards that make them want to Facetune.
Right. And it's so frustrating to me as a plus size person to look at Chloe, who could have been a body positive advocate since 2006.
Yeah.
Just deeply fall into the like oppressive nature of being a woman in media and in fame.
Yeah.
And watching her sisters benefit. And then on top of that, not only like your true love soulmate of your life, Lamar, completely loses his mind and you can't save him. Right. And she has daddy issues because she lost her father at a young age. Like when she was 16 when Robert died. So that's a whole, you know, that not daddy issues like in a bad way, but like not having your father there is affects you no matter what. I mean, mine wasn't in my life and it affected me still when he passed. So, and when she's 6 months pregnant, the day that she's giving birth, the news breaks that her baby daddy has cheated on her, not once, but twice.
Yeah.
And now she's back with that man. And so everyone has opinions about everything. And so I can't imagine, I can't imagine what that pressure must feel like, but it's also the unrecognition of the power that she has to change the narrative is so wild and so interesting in the scheme of all of this conversation about our bodies and female bodies specifically.
Yeah. I think there's a really interesting thing there about like, I have the right to show my body however I want, do whatever I want to my body. And like, yes, you do. But also, like, I'm begging you to interrogate why you want to do a lot of those things. Like,
yeah.
Think about it and think about where it's coming from and who you're doing it for. And, like, if maybe, just maybe, like, it would help you to not put so much of your self-worth into it.
Right. It's like on a smaller scale for me, it's makeup. Like, I used to wear makeup every single day, mm-hmm. full face. I would go to college classes with full face of makeup, fully dressed, like, put so much time and effort into it. And I love fashion. So it's something that I still love to do. And I love to dress up and have fun with the clothes that I'm wearing. But it definitely began because I had to look better than everyone else because I was already starting at a disadvantage. So I had to make sure that my hair, my makeup, my outfit was on point because I already had points against me because I was fat.
Yeah.
And that's not my narrative of dressing up anymore or using makeup or fixing my hair, or like, I dye my hair red because I love it. It is my vibe. It's who I am now, mm-hmm. but I don't do it because I feel like I have to, or I don't put makeup on because I feel like I have to, or I don't dress cute because I feel like I have to. Those things genuinely make me feel good,
yeah,
and feel better rather than it something that I have to do in order yeah. to be as good as other people.
For sure. I actually feel that way with few things. Honestly, something that comes to my mind is belting, because I felt for a long time I have to belt the highest and the loudest in order to ever be taken seriously, because I have to make up for my size. And do like vocally like impressive, and you know, like, it's I still am like, I feel like a weird way if I sing a song in an audition that does not have like a high show off note. I'm sure mm-hmm. other folks feel like this, but I like, it's taken me a long time to like find songs that I love instead of feeling like I have to like vocally compensate. And by compensate, I mean apologize. I mean be like, I'm sorry I look like this. Here's a high note to make up for it. That's what it is.
Yes, I understand. It's interesting to think about belting in that way, because I only just thought about it because I was like, everyone has to do this. And if you don't do mm-hmm. it, then you're different. Then like, you're different in a bad way from everyone else.
Yeah. I can actually pinpoint the exact moment for me where I was like, I got a belt. And it was when I saw Alicia Umpress as the Heather understudy in American Idiot. And she was phenomenal. She blew me away. Good. And she was the first person I had ever seen on stage who was bigger than like a size 2 on Broadway. And mm-hmm. I was like, oh my God, a person did this. I could do this. I just have to sound exactly like her and be as good as her. And oh my God, that's fucking impossible. She's incredible. You know what I mean?
Yeah, she's otherworldly. She's yes, so good.
Absolutely. And I think that not being otherworldly, I mean, maybe I'm otherworldly in other ways and I have my own skills, but like, not being so exceptional of a singer should not preclude me from pursuing theater or musical theater.
Yeah, totally. And I, because I am trained classically first and mm-hmm. not musical theater first, my classical voice, I'm a mezzo soprano. And I mm-hmm. kind of say that like mezzo soprano in classical music is like soprano in musical theater.
Yeah.
That's why I can fake my way through a lot of these ingenue roles that I've right. sung. My voice is just trained so much better to use that mixier, chestier sound. Mm-hmm. And like going up to the B flat above middle C, not the like the highest one, but the low, the one in the middle of the
staff, middle line of the staff. Yeah.
Yeah. And like really using like honestly, Marmee songs from Little Women, my voice fits those. It's like butter. There's the timbre of, just because they wrote them for the original actress in Little Women. Mm-hmm. So, and her voice was very like rich. Like one of my favorite compliments I've ever gotten was that my voice sounded like how it felt drinking a glass of red wine.
Oh, that's very nice.
Oh my gosh. From Father David at Villanova. He was the head of the department when I first went in there. And he had said that to me. And I was like, that is the best compliment I have ever gotten. But it's very true. I have a darker timbre to my voice. Mm-hmm. And the older roles fit that. So I just didn't even think about it because my voice fit that so much.
Yeah.
And then I really wasn't, it took me a really long time to figure out what my belt and my high mix belt was and how to manage my lower tone and the fullness of it versus this higher belt that wasn't as, it was a brighter, and like blending those two things. Like it's such, I think that belting is the biggest misconception for people who don't understand musical theater, because it's incredibly difficult. And it's just not the type of belt that Sutton Foster is going to do is a different type of belt from what Jessica Vosk is going to do.
And the type of belt you'll do from show to show is different too.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. It's so, so difficult. And we're also in this very, I don't, whatever you want to feel about it, time of musical theater composition. It's just higher and higher and higher and asking so much.
For sure. Yeah. And then also you're like, oh, you need to be able to do everything so you can work in every way. And I always sort of felt like, to be honest, as a person of my size, that didn't apply to me. And like I had these high soprano notes in even as young as like middle school, and like I had the soprano range that my voice teachers were always excited about and wanted me to develop, and they wanted me to develop a stronger mix so I could sing more legit repertoire. And I was like, fuck that, I want a belt high, like I just want to be loud and I want to show off so I'll get praise and like so I can be Elphaba one day, because my whole plan was to I was like, sometime in high school, I shall lose enough weight to be able to play Elphaba after I get out of college, which did not happen. But actually, I'm ready to play Elphaba now. Give me a call.
yeah. Ready to take the stage. So it's so complicated, like what your voice is built for and if that fits into what you want to do. And then also like, for the funny character, crazy actresses, sometimes, we do have to show off our voices more and be able to belt and be able to riff. And I was this classically trained little nerd. And I was like, I still don't feel comfortable riffing.
I mean, I'm that's be really like honest. Also, that's like times 10 for Black women, too.
Oh, my God.
It's like if you are not the body that we're used to seeing, then you have to like make up for it vocally. That's what it's always struck me as. And in that way, it's a really gross thing in theater. I think maybe because of that, fat women are sort of pushed toward like a more stereotypically Black vocal style. And I have often been assigned repertoire that I should not be singing as a white person because of that.
It is really interesting to think about it that way. And then it can all be led back to the way that operas were written and how voices were styled, and that pants roles were for specifically for mezzos because of the sound of their voice, and how much the music influences the type of person that you are or the story that you're telling, and how like at the beginning it really was like when you hear this song, what pops into your head first and why those things, and then you perpetuate it in the story.
But
obviously we shouldn't be doing that still now, because we are so much more aware as a society on some level of the
interesting. It's a little bit basic and lazy.
It's boring.
Absolutely. So while we're on this, sort of like representations of music in terms of what they tell the audience, can you explain a little bit more about your thesis and about the whole feminist methodology that you created?
Yes, I can. Thank you. So like I said, it started as an idea trying to find out if Janine Tesori's work with Lisa Crohn was any more feminist than the work with the other male playwrights that she had worked with on her previous shows. So for those of you that aren't Janine Tesori stans, first of all, I highly recommend. Second of all, the shows in somewhat chronological order, Violent was before anything else, but it wasn't on Broadway. And so I am referencing in my paper, and when I talk about it, I'm talking about the most recent production of Violet that starred Sutton Foster. So It was Thoroughly Modern Millie, Caroliner Change, Shrek, Violet, and then ending with Fun Home. Yes, there were five. Okay, so ending with Fun Home. And I took one song from each show and I analyzed whether or not the way that the music was written, whether or not it supported the woman in what she was doing or it didn't. And if it was because what she was pursuing was part of patriarchy or not part of patriarchy. So for example, my first song that I look at is Gimme Gimme from Thoroughly Modern Millie. And as Millie becomes more of the accepting of the love that she has for Jimmy, the music swells, there's more orchestration, it's louder, it's bigger, it propels her into declaring her love for Jimmy.
Yeah.
And that is supporting her getting away from her original idea of having autonomy over her decision to be married for money. And instead, yeah, getting rid of that idea that was her own and marrying for love, which is a patriarchal value at the time of like that, whoa, purity of it. And that she, while, you know, it is still her decision to love Jimmy,
mm-hmm,
but the music still supports her in that way because it's going into that value. Whereas, yeah, when she's struggling between this decision, the music is way more minimal.
Mm-hmm.
And then when she finally accepts it, Jimmy, oh Jimmy, yeah, mm-hmm, she's like, ah, and then it becomes crazy at the end. So that kind of idea. And so my basis of my analysis is believing that if we are in patriarchy,
yeah,
then everything that we've ever been taught and the way that there are rules to writing are inherently patriarchal, because, yeah, there were no things, or from what we understand of history and in the patriarchal way, how many times, take a shot every time I say patriarchy in this podcast. Don't drive though. be careful, drink responsibly. But there were no opportunities for women to become the storytellers.
Yeah. It's like the whole male orgasm climax structure of the of story structure.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. There's no, women didn't have that opportunity to develop these stories, to develop a way of writing and things like that.
Yeah.
So if you start to look at the way things are written and they deviate from the structure that we're taught of in any way or form, I believe that it's inherently feminist. And with all rules in liberal arts, it is not black and white, and there are exceptions to all of these things. There are male playwrights who can be extremely misogynistic, who do interesting things in their structure of storytelling. But I do feel that if we are looking at musical theater in its patriarchal form, it's boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl back.
It's one of the most heteronormative forms of storytelling, I suppose.
Yeah, it's 100%. And that's how it started. That's how stories are structured and built off of this Rodgers and Hammerstein idea of that boy gets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl back mentality. So anything that deviates from that structure, I claimed it to be feminist, and I used, you know, lots of other amazing female writers and feminist analysis to help support. I would take things from feminist analysis of like movie structure and apply it. And then I took it down to even like the minuscule level of like, why is there a guitar here instead? And I did. It was like building of analysis. It was like, gimme, gimme, mm-hmm, we're going to talk about this concept. And then in Caroliner Change, I did Lot's Wife. And we talked about different concepts. And I'm going to be honest, I can't name them specifically right now. You know, I put a lot of myself into that 46-page paper. And I just now feel 4 years later that I am ready to look into it and be able to criticize my own analysis.
Yeah.
But the basis and the spark of my feminist musical theater analysis in general was when I was introduced to Stacey Wolf in my musical theater class in grad school. that was taught by Dr. Valerie Joyce, who's the head of the department right now at Villanova. And we had, she just assigned us an essay where she talked about, where Stacey Wolf talked about Maria from Sound of Music, because she also, Stacey Wolf also has books about queer analysis in musical theater. It's very great. She has a book called How Do You Solve a Problem Like Maria, where she takes queer analysis of like famous actors and the parts that made them famous. So like Mary Martin and Peter Pan and Barbara Streisand and Funny Girl. And like, it's just, it's very, very cool. And then, so then later on, she wrote a book called, it's literally right here next to me. She wrote a book called Change for Good, A Feminist History of the Broadway Musical. And she does a feminist analysis of major shows from each decade and talks about what made them have feminist value or why they didn't. My favorite chapter is about the 1980s, and she talks about how the sets themselves isolate the women from the story, because like in most of the women, the only woman that gets to the barricade is Eponine, and spoiler alert, she dies.
And she's dressed like a guy to do it.
And then in Phantom, Christine's own space of her dressing room gets invaded by the Phantom and by Raoul, and they and then when she's alone at the singing at the graveyard, and then they both come in and take over that space that she has with her father there. Oh my gosh. I just flipped open to a paragraph highlighted about what she talks about. This should I read a sentence from
it?
Okay, so Stacey Wolf says, within Les Mis's performative architecture, women occupy a sonic and visual space outside of the key action and themes, and off and away from the complex and entrancing machinations of the set that the musical values. The musical's principal women are excluded from these impressive, visually engaging, and thematic significant scenes. Each female has a song that is staged with the woman alone. And this way, Les Mis deserts the actor by isolating her from visual elements altogether. Les Mis diminishes women by exiling from the set and forcing them outside of the world of the play. I get chills. I get chills reading it. That's how deeply I love this woman. I mean, and everything she's saying, it just like clicks in your brain. Like, oh yeah. The women don't ever interact with each other in this play. And how insane is that? You know, or like, and then, and breaking it down to even the way that the set is structured and how that affects the women just totally blew my mind.
Yeah.
And then like the biggest part of this book is her deep analysis of Wicked and how she does a queer feminist analysis of Elphaba and Glinda's relationship.
They fuck in the book. They do.
she looks at them through a heteronormative storytelling structure and how Elphaba and Glinda are the relationship in the story that you follow. That you can
That's so interesting.
You can take Fiero out of the story completely and it doesn't change what happens. So it just completely, and then and you know, it's a little old. It goes like 1990 through the 2000s. And then there's also a chapter about how the fandom of Wicked was like unlike we had seen for women in a long time for a show about women. I just highly recommend Change for Good for anyone who, if you like musical theater history, if you are a feminist, if you are also, if you are someone who is still trying to figure out what your feminism is.
Yeah.
And you want to understand it through the lens of something that you care about, like musical theater.
Yeah.
Then I highly recommend reading anything of hers, literally, and start with an article and see how you feel. But it, for me, it completely changed my world because in grad school, my mind just became more expanded. I became aware of more feminist ideas. I also was, you know, just post-grad and like knew I was a feminist, but didn't really understand all the complexities of it and didn't understand intersectionality and like didn't know about a lot of things that I, as a white person, had never been exposed to before. Mm-hmm. I never thought of exposing myself to before because I was in the privilege of not having to. So when I realized that musical theater and now that could be academic and thoughtful and more than just anything, it really, really helped me because I actively am someone who, especially teaching kids and teaching students and having to do the more basic kind of shows, having to do mm-hmm. a lot of Disney productions and having to do a lot of age appropriate, school appropriate
right.
things that tend to be more misogynistic, that tend to mm-hmm. be less valuable an idea for women. I have to find that value for my students. Yeah. I have to help these women, these girls, not women. I have to help these girls find their value because I so desperately want them to know that they have it.
Yeah.
I really actively am still feminist in thought and ideology, no matter what age I'm teaching,
for
because
sure.
I think it starts so young.
It does. These things get ingrained in the very, very young children. You can yeah. tell. I'm a babysitter and I babysit at a lot of different houses. You can tell when the kid has already been exposed to patriarchal ideas. You can 100%. Tell when the you know, I use a gender neutral language and they're like, that's silly. Why would I ever marry another boy or like whatever? You can just tell. And often it honestly does relate to how much media the kid has consumed.
Yeah, absolutely. And who's like helping them teach it? Like who mm-hmm. is anyone teaching them? Are they allowed? But I try my best to like really teach it to them as well.
The younger you are when you challenge it, the more expansive your worldview can be in the rest of your life.
Yes.
So how did the Fat Ingenue come about? Like, how did you decide on that username and how did that come to you?
I, like most millennials, put off getting TikTok for a while. And I just was like, I don't want to watch videos. That's really where it like ended for me. I was like, good for them. It's great. Don't understand. Whatever. And I'm sure I was a little pretentious about it at some time because I am known to be pretentious sometimes. And then, you know, the pandemic hit and here we are. And then I downloaded it probably because my sister was like sending me videos and I was like, all right, let's just figure this out. Let's do it. And I didn't have a username at first. I just was one of those people that just wanted to watch the videos.
Like user 567 day.
Yeah, for the longest time. And I found in the little niche of TikTok that I became in, which was a lot of body positivity, a lot of drag queens, mm-hmm. a lot of reality television things, and you know the dancer here and there or whatever, like the random other things that come up every so often mm-hmm. in your feed. And I really started to notice that what I was seeing was very positive, and I felt like there was this element of wanting to be educated in the videos that I was seeing that were successful and speaking out against something. I think yeah. that it has been proven time and time again mm-hmm. that Gen Z is an activist generation and
yeah.
really, really and hopefully and truly can be a generation that actually advocates and makes change happen. Hopefully. I mean, that's yeah. very optimistic. And I hope that to be true. I hope that as millennials get older, we're less gross than the generations that have power now. One can dream. But all that is to say is that I just recognized that on the platform, that there was an educational activist kind of speaking out. And because I was in queer talk, if you will, mm-hmm. a lot of people encouraging, promoting themselves as, or just generally like be yourself, being themselves and then being rewarded for it on the platform. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how the Fat Ingenue, the name itself, came into my brain, but it just came into my brain one day and I like mentioned it to a couple people and I was like, I think I'm going to do something with this, but I don't know what yet. Mm-hmm. And then I had the idea for musical theater roles I can't play because I'm fat.
Yeah.
Because it felt so natural to me of like mm-hmm. calling out the system that I wanted to call out, and then also getting the chance to perform as myself, like not perform as myself, but perform for myself and do the things that I've always wanted to do and play roles that I've never thought of playing before while still having this message behind it. And so I made it. I like figured out what my like thesis statement was, which is intersectional feminist body positivity through a musical theater lens. That's what I came up with and mm-hmm. how to explain what it is that I was doing.
Yeah.
I am calling out in a feminist way because I am a woman. So me calling out the societal norms is inherently feminist in my thought. Mm-hmm. And proving with my performance how stupid that idea is yeah. that I can't play that role because I'm fat.
Yeah.
Because, you know, my message of it is more important to me than my performance of it.
Yes.
Because my performances aren't perfect. I'm not trying to win a Tony. I want to sound good and be good, but I want to prove that even this performance, this little 30-second clip that you're seeing is enough to prove yeah. all of the reasons why anyone who looks like me or who is othered in any way can play this part.
Yeah. Just having the balls to sing that material is radical in a way. Because I mean, I have been scared to sing that stuff for so long. I refused point blank to sing love songs until college. And even then, I only sang unrequited love songs.
Yeah. And I just love those songs. Like, I truly am so passionate about musical theater. I am a musical theater nerd. Like, I really deeply love it as much as I say that I do. And I love the history of it. And I love, mm-hmm. I love the evolution of how musical theater has began to where it's gotten to and where it could go.
Yeah.
Because in storytelling, in performance art, it is the youngest form of the storytelling structure that we know of. Like, of course, there's always like singing, like telling stories through song, and there was spoken word, and there's been performance, and there's plays. But the literal structure of musical theater, American musical theater that we know of mm-hmm. today, is very young. You know, there wasn't yeah. the structures and what we were seeing until that 40s time when it started to pick up speed.
Right.
So I am very hopeful in the direction that it could go. And I also just know that poor playwrights are the only just writers in general have to compete with dead people yeah. To get their stuff produced.
Yeah.
And because of the inherent business nature of theater, golden age things are going to keep being done until yeah. we get to a place where we're like, okay, we're done with this now. But for the foreseeable future, I don't see that stopping.
Yeah, I'm pro golden age, actually. I think that there's a lot of things we can take from those. And sometimes, like, watching a history play where, you know, unconscionable things do happen is a good learning experience.
Yeah, and I believe that there are dramaturgical ways to do the show in which you can combat those things.
Yes, ditto. And I wish more people made that a priority instead of just giving people what is comfortable for them and they've always seen, which you can keep yeah. while still pushing the envelope in a golden age piece.
Yeah, because you can, like, this is my greatest example of how musical theater can be so much more than people give it credit for, than people who, like, when I, and I'm saying, like, not theater people, not people who enjoy and consume theater, but, and, or even not people who are educated in what theater is, but yeah. the consumer of people I'm talking about.
Right.
They can go see a production of Putnam County Spelling Bee and be like, oh, this is so enjoyable. These crazy kids, right? That mm-hmm. can be it. The music's funny. It's interactive. Like, it's got the bits. It's a good time feeling show. Or you can be like me and see that production in January of 2017 and sob as Logan Shorten Groove, whatever her last name is, right? Sings, I hope you still love me, America, and think about Hillary Clinton and sob. There are ways to make musical theater have profound meaning. And especially with Golden Age, why shouldn't we be trying to do that with that form?
For sure.
And it's definitely something that developed as an idea for me in grad school and learning deeply about theater, and also really becoming aware of how much theater is just reproduced of the same thing over and over again.
So much, yeah.
And how, while I would give to see any like classic production right now in the theater, and I would just cry to be in a theater, mm-hmm. you know, I'm not really interested in seeing the same two type of people fall in love and sing and do all the same and have the cast all look the same and everyone's kicking their face. And like, I'm not necessarily interested in that. I'm interested in that if it aids the story.
Yeah.
But I'm not interested in the spectacle just for spectacle's sake. Sometimes that's great. I mean, and I love spectacle. Don't get me wrong. It's all Frozen and I loved it. And it was all spectacle. And I love that. But when you go to a Disney show, you expect to see Disney magic.
Yeah.
You know? So yeah, it's a very complex and interesting thing. And for me, with these songs and these ingenues, these old school shows, and I've been doing more contemporary as of now, the songs that had been my most successful videos were songs where the audience of the TikToks was thinking about how the fat body would influence the story itself.
Yes.
Whereas for me, it was just the fact that I was playing a leading lady at all that was inherently feminist and radicalized enough for my own belief system. Where when people were seeing My Fair Lady, I Could Have Danced All Night, so Eliza.
Yeah. I actually, this is so silly. I had this idea for a retelling of the story of Pygmalion, but like with Henry Higgins as like a nutritionist and like personal trainer, and Eliza Doolittle as like a fat woman.
Oh my God. Yeah. I mean, that's my highest video that was successful. That was crazy because it was like my fourth video that I had done. And I was like, oh my God. And then I started to watch the comments come in about how much it would be an interesting story and prove that Eliza's even further outside of the society that he's trying to make her be a part of and all that stuff. And I hadn't even considered it. I was literally like, I love this song. I'm going to sing it, you know, and I've never seen a plus size Eliza. They just totally opened that idea. I was like, oh, that's so interesting to think about. And then the next video that became very popular was when I did Meet the Plastics, the Regina George verse from Mean Girls. And again, I did it because I had like a full beat and my hair looked great and I was wearing a hot pink outfit. And I was like, what can I do with this? And I had debated on doing this on October 3rd of 2020 because I was like, oh, it'll work. And then the line about I never weigh more than 115 stopped me from doing it.
Oh.
And then I was like, you know what? I'm going to do a wink after I do it. I'm going to make this whole thing cheesy. Just do it, because I go back and forth with my feelings on Mean Girls, but I do think that Meet the Plastics is incredibly well written. I think that each little snippet of each of the Plastics makes perfect sense for who they are. And I was going at it from like, Regina is so delusional that she thinks that no one can touch her. And that in Regina's mind, she does not weigh more than 115, because you're not going to tell her that she does. You know what I mean? And I didn't really think about it beyond that. I just knew that like, I, Like I said, I love a villain. So I knew, like, Regina is just in my soul. I probably, since that movie came out, I've been like wanting, I would live to play a character as like evil as that, as horrible as she is. Cause it's so fun. Cause you can't do that way in real life, but you can be horrible on stage. It's like the best part of playing a villain. And then that one took off really and did really well. And it was the same thing. Comments talking about, oh my God, I love a plus size Regina. Like, I think it makes her seem more delusional. I think this, that, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, again, wow, I'm really so surprised. Cause I put it out there, honestly, kind of scared, because just like with every fandom, people can go crazy. You know,
they for sure.
Get psycho about things. And so to have it be so well received, I was very surprised and happy and thought that was interesting. And then a video with moderate success after that was I did Part of Your World from Little Mermaid.
Mm-hmm.
And again, people were talking about how being a like mermaids would actually be plus size because scientifically fish have fat on them to make them warmer and blah 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 blah.
I'm obsessed with that.
And again, like how important, how like interesting and cool, and like how, and people were finding the dramaturgical evidence that I was talking about taking these shows and making them mean something else. People in the comments of TikTok were finding that dramaturgical evidence for sure. Why it would make sense. Which were like those comments are so much better than the, well, just audition. Well, why not? Well, why don't you? It's like, do you not understand how jobs work? Have you ever been like, I would like to be the assistant, administrative assistant, and I'm going to do that now. Like, you have to get hired, you weirdos. Like, what do you mean? Just do it. Thank you so much. Thank, oh my God, I've been doing this for God knows how many years now, but I never thought of just doing it. Thank you so much.
Right?
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Sassy tangent.
No, it's all good. It's all good. No, I think it's so interesting, and especially the Ariel thing in particular, like it speaks to what we perceive as believable. You know, because like I feel like so many fat women have been turned away from Ariel and been like, oh, well, no one will believe you as the romantic lead. It's like you don't believe that a man can fall in love with someone who's bigger, but you do believe that a scientifically impossible fish girl exists. Like, so silly. It comes up again and again. And I think it's so important to like point out that sort of logical fallacy of it, because fat phobia is so ingrained that people think that it is just like, it is the world and it is facts. And it's not. It's opinions and biases.
Right. Yes.
So this actually brings us perfectly to Cast Me Cowards. Can we go there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Awesome. So what is your number one dream role that you would never be cast in because of your size?
Oh my God, this question. This question is, I've known about this question. And I had an answer for this question, and I think my answer is still the same, but I also have another answer that I
rattle them off, baby. Go for it.
My initial response of this question is Elle from Legally Blonde. I love that show so much. And while I always spout that Paulette is one of my dream roles, and it is, I would love to be Paulette. I can sing Ireland in my sleep. It is one of my favorite things to do. But Elle is Elle. And God, wouldn't it be good to be her, you know, for that show? It is just, it's so fun. It's so emotional. It's so genuine. I love Legally Blonde so much. And then my other answer to that question is Jenna from Waitress, which
that's a great
there is
one.
Still plenty of time for a professional company to cast a plus size Jenna to make this dream closer to reality.
Give Lexi a call.
Oh my God, please give me a call.
Let's talk about the dramaturgy there. I think it completely would support. I mean, even if you're going to go completely base stereotypes, she works at a pie shop, she makes food, like, cast a fat woman. Even if you're going to go like to the lower class, she married a guy who abuses her, cast a fat woman.
Yeah. And also to think about it in that way of God, you know, the dowdy white women are becoming the straight white male of, you know, movies and television and musicals now of like,
define dowdy.
Like, One, I think that Jenna at the start of the musical, they want her to be like dowdier and like she's not well done up. She's this outsider.
Yeah,
she's
okay,
a,
yeah.
She's lower class. She has a waitressing job that's less than blah, 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 right? They're always trying to find ways for us to believe that these gorgeous white women mm-hmm. are not gorgeous white women, you know?
Yes.
Not to say that gorgeous white people can't have issues. They absolutely can.
But there's but, you know, so
we've
many.
Seen it a
like,
lot.
Yeah, so many examples yeah. of like, she's the ugly girl at school. And it's like, no, 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 no. Like, she's literally just a beautiful, thin white girl with glasses or bangs. Right. Like,
or
what?
Like someone who doesn't care that they're beautiful, which is also fine, you mm-hmm. know? Or like who doesn't care about beauty standards,
but then that's like idealized too because it's like, oh, right. she's different than the other girls because yeah. caring about your beauty and femininity is bad.
Yes, absolutely. So people who are othered are more likely to stay in abusive relationships because they feel like they won't be able to find anyone else.
Yes, so common, so,
so
common for
why-
fat people.
Yeah. So why can't Jenna be fat? And why shouldn't she be?
Because we root for her. Because she's the protagonist. And because, I'm sorry, I've gotten on the soapbox yeah. so many times. But it's because yeah. people, and or maybe it's just that like the higher ups and the decision makers like don't think people will be able to root for a person yes. whose body they perceive as a moral failure. But I truly think that that is why. I remember on this podcast, one of my guests talked about how he was passed up for Charlie Brown because of his size and it was given to a tall, thin person. And when he asked why, they were like, you're just never going to play a lead. Like Charlie Brown, a like complete social outcast, is the one who can't be fat because he's the lead. And it just like just made this like light bulb go on my brain where it's like, no, the reason fat people aren't leads is because our bodies are so coded as disgusting failures and that like we can't even stand to root for one. We can't even see one as more than just their size.
Right. And that I'm sure with your more than Tracy Turnblad, you know more than anyone in like looking at production of Tracy that the other thought behind it of not putting a fat person as a lead is that we cannot physically sustain it.
Oh, for sure. That's huge.
So in regard to Tracy, people will put people in fat suits to play a fat yeah. woman because they don't believe that actual fat people can make it through. No, because when I was in my time of age to play Tracy, I 100,000% could have gotten through that show easy peasy, no problem.
Yeah, for sure. You were like a serious dancer. Hello. Like what?
Yeah, I definitely had the stamina. I never had the opportunity, and now I'm old and I'm also tall. So like with all of this stuff about me not being able to play leads because of being a fat woman, also for me, it's that I'm 5'10". So mm-hmm. I also just don't fit. I'm fat and 5'10", so I can't even be a part of a chorus unless I'm like in the chorus as a ghost of the Addams Family. You know what I mean? Like creepy, kooky things.
Right. You know, I actually think that the height thing is such an interesting intersection here too, because it really throws into sharp relief how much this is like heteronormative gender roles and like yeah. how much that actually also plays into anti-fatness. Because I think that if the woman is too tall or if the woman is larger than the man, physically bigger than like a male romantic counterpart or than like the prototypical male romantic counterpart, then that is what makes people uncomfortable. And that's like a big reason that also short men don't get cast. Yeah. And you hear a lot of women being like, well, I don't want to date a guy who's smaller than me because that will make me feel so big, you know? Yeah. So it's just all really tied together. Like size itself is a thing and then fat is yeah. a thing. And yeah, it's so gendered.
It is ridiculous. And it can't be sustained anymore. The yeah. idea of the way, I mean, and I.
Too many of us are watching TikToks that challenge it. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we're being challenged constantly. I think that there are, you know, this is not everyone. Not everyone is liberal and not everyone can see the society for what it is. Mm-hmm. But we are challenging the structure of our entire society of America.
Yeah.
Because the capitalistic idea, the capitalistic ideals are hurting us.
Yes.
They're killing us. And like, it is absolutely unsustainable. There has to be change everywhere. We went from needing change politically and to needing change in every facet of our society.
Yes.
Because they all build upon each other, that perpetuate the capitalistic idea that we don't all inherently deserve to live and have decent lives.
Yes. And that everything that happens to us is our fault. Everything seems to go back to blaming the individual. Like, everything.
Yeah.
I think about it absolutely constantly.
Yeah, I mean, it's just wild. It's really interesting. I think that the best way that this is going to advocate real change is when we see it in professional theaters, that they are the ones doing shows with unconventional leads. And I think, unfortunately, it's going to have to start with Broadway, and then we'll trickle down to regional. But I hope that regional theaters stop perpetuating that they have to be as good as Broadway and have to be the same thing as Broadway.
Yes.
Because no matter what, no matter how hard you try, it's not. So stop pretending like it is, you know? And there are incredible regional productions happening
all over
this country. Amazing things, amazing theater is being done,
but they're not gonna be Broadway. They're not, and trying to be that exact same thing is just kind of devaluing the regional theaters themselves, because it's literally just marketing yourself as a knockoff of something else.
Yeah, totally. So, you know, I think that there is a community that's building for it now. I think that body size is such in a weird place with all the activism and movements, because it is including fat people, but it is also like making sure that people of color, Black people, Indigenous people, queer people, trans people, like all different kinds of people outside of the heteronormative cisgendered people are included. And I think that body size gets forgotten about. And it is because of that, like, physical stamina and...
Right, right. And because people think it's deserved, I think, at the end of the day. They can argue that it's deserved in a way that they can't argue that other oppressions are, because it's supposedly under your control.
Yeah. I'm hopeful that we'll see theaters reopening and hopefully having the money to produce things. And it'll be very interesting to see what theaters are stuck in a pre-COVID world, and what theaters have been paying attention with what's been happening in the past
really
year.
I really hope we have awakened during this time a little bit to all of the ways that capitalism harms us. I hope I'm not getting in trouble for saying that on a podcast.
I mean, I certainly believe it. I don't know how to escape it on my own. But I mean,
you can't, and you're
it.
Not responsible for doing that, right? Because then you're just putting the onus on the individual again.
Right. See, it's so, I mean,
it's so insidious.
I scream once a week about how all of our education as children is just propaganda to make us believe that we're the best place on earth. And it's just so far from the truth.
Yeah. And just propaganda to make us obey and like not question. Yeah.
Yeah. And as someone who believes in education, it really is very like frustrating for me.
Oh my God. And you're like up close and personal with kids who are going through that right now.
Yeah. And I mean, I just, as the creative person in their life, as the theater teacher in their life, as the music teacher in their life, I say comments and I make things and I do things that fight against it actively. I come to work in Black Lives Matter shirts. I wear feminist stuff all the time. I just really, and like, so my social media is not private, and I have this public platform of the Fat Ingenue that any one of my high school students could find. A lot of them do, and like, it really and I'm very lucky to work in spaces that also have the same idealistic values as I do,
yeah,
and you know, aren't I'm not doing anything outside of appropriateness for the age given, but
for sure,
you know, I but, really yeah. try to, I say on a regular, gender's a construct. Yeah. I just say that. And then if they don't know what that means, they're going to go, they got to go find out, you know?
And you know what? I bet they will. Cause for all the evil of the internet, it does expose people to these ideas a lot younger. I mean, I credit Tumblr with like my feminist awakening and like a lot of really good things that happened to me. Yes. So yeah.
Amazing.
All right. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for this amazing and very long chat.
Of course. Oh my God.
Truly enjoy talking with you so much, and I love your content. And folks who are listening to this who may not have seen the Fat Ingenue, go and follow her.
TikTok and Instagram.
Yes. Yes. TikTok and Instagram. And Lexi, I wish you all the best.
Thank you. Thank you so much. You too. It was so fun.
Anytime. Bye-bye. Thank you so much for listening to More Than Tracy Turnblad. If you liked it, hit subscribe and leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts. That would be awesome. Also, follow us on social media, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok, all at More Than Tracy T. And just tell your friends. Word of mouth is great, too. You can find more information at morethantracyturnblad.com.